Thank you so much, and thank you very much for inviting me here. This is the first time I've spoken at a foundation event, as I am a trustee, because I find foundation debates always so very useful and informative, and I hope I'm not going to change that. I'm afraid that I do have to leave almost as soon as I speak to vote in the House on social care, but I hope to come back for the rest of the debate later on. And I want to thank you to Patrick for setting out the evidence base so well. What I am going to do, as not surprisingly, is set out the same sort of the problem from a political perspective and the solutions from a political perspective as well. I'm the Shadow Minister for Industrial Strategy and Science and Innovation, so this, if you like, is my day job, as well as representing Newcastle Central. And I'm also a chartered engineer. And I'd start by saying that I am a believer in science for science's sake. I think it's part of our innate humanity to seek to push back the boundaries of human knowledge. And here in the UK, we have a fantastic world-leading scientific tradition, from Isaac Newton to Stephen Hawking, from Ada Lovelace to Rosalind Franklin, and today Leslie Yellowlease, Jocelyn Bell Burnell, and Newcastle-born Peter Higgs. Britain's scientific greats bestride the world. And our science sector continues to power our economy. 29% of the UK workforce are employed in science roles, and these employees earn 40% more than the average wage. So that's part of the reason for the gender pay gap, given science's poor diversity record. And science jobs are projected to be created at twice the rate of other jobs over the next 5 years. So science is absolutely critical to curating the high skill, high wage, and high productivity economy that we in the Labour Party want, and that the government wants too. Yet, as we've heard, our country lags far behind other developed nations when it comes to R&D, spending just 1.7%, and compared to the average, the OECD average of 2.4%, OECD average of 2.4%, and the 4.2% of the high flyers such as Israel and Korea. So if we're all agreed that science is so important, and I take the point of, why aren't we financing it properly? Part of the answer is in the question, finance, or rather financialization. So this is the 10th anniversary year of the financial crisis, not something we're celebrating so much. And as the economists Mariana Mazzucato and Laurie McFarlane wrote in a recent report, the banking sector has largely retreated from funding the real economy. Now, that's nothing new. In the 1980s, Margaret Thatcher declared our future was services and financial services in particular, that we would let the world be our workshop and keep our hands clean. I remember that phrase particularly well because I was studying electrical engineering at Imperial at the time. And where would I find a job, I wondered. I never wanted for a job, but I worked all over the world, but never in the Northeast, which was deindustrialized. And a more macro consequence of this was the financialization of our economy. So today, just under 3 million people work in the manufacturing sector, a third of what it was 50 years ago, while as a percentage of GDP, our financial sector is now larger than that of any other G7 economy. I mean, this is pre-Brexit. And this has coincided, and I would, correlation is not causation, but I'll go on to explain what some of the driving factors may be. It's coincided with a decline in our national R&D spend. Now, there are two key reasons for this, in my view. The first is that the financial sector has stopped resourcing the real economy. Instead of investing in companies which produce stuff, finance is financing finance. So why invest in a long-term R&D project when you can make a bet on some options hedged with other options and guarantee a return in a few weeks? And low investment in the real economy, it directly impacts manufacturing and some services, but it also, as a consequence, impacts science because, you know, fewer manufacturers and businesses investing in improving their productivity means less demand for innovation and therefore pulling through less demand for R&D. And the second impact of financialization, I would argue, is how it changes the motives behind economic activity, giving investors with short-term interests more control. This results in less reinvestment of profits and rising debt, which makes industry even more prone to short-term thinking, which is not conducive to spending on R&D, which by definition takes time to produce a return. And I'll just give one example of that. GKN, and our proudest and oldest engineering firms, which was taken over earlier this year by Melrose. GKN employed 650 people in R&D roles around the country, investing $561 million in the UK alone between 2000 and 2010. Melrose, on the other hand, spends only a fifth as much on R&D as a proportion of sales, and has a track record of breaking up and selling the companies it acquires. And we've looked, I think, Patrick's work on looking at the sort of some of the issues around the ownership of our R&D base is going to be reflected in the work that we are doing in looking at the takeover regime. But to unlock our country's innovation potential, we believe we need to turn the tide of financialization. And this is what Labour's industrial strategy is engineered to do. Now, one of our missions, our visions for the country, our missions is to build an innovation nation. So investing in science and technology and critically democratizing the benefits so that works for everyone. So we want innovation to be part of our cultural DNA, not in narrow segments of society, but across the board. And this is backed up by our £250 billion. So it is sort of one of the key areas where our strategy differs from the government strategy is that we have significant funding behind it. So there's a National Transformation Fund for Infrastructure, and in addition, a National Investment Bank, which will be made up of a network of regional investment banks, you know, where investment decisions can be taken locally, and that will invest in scientific excellence and research and development across the country. So now that's our vision, and we have, you know, I think Patrick set out some of the policy instruments, and what we are doing right now is working on the detailed measures. Now, our National Policy Forum consultation attracted hundreds of submissions, which made very interesting reading over the summer with a number of interesting proposals. So our commitment, you know, is to raising public and private R&D spend to 3% by 2030. So we don't believe in going for being average because we believe, as I said, innovation needs to be the driving factor behind the kind of economy we want to deliver. So how are we going to do that? Well, we have said that we will make an additional 1.3 billion of public investment available in our first two years of office, and that will immediately raise R&D spending to 1.85% of GDP. And much of this additional spend will be drawn on by our industrial strategy missions. And so one mission is to create an innovation nation. Another mission is to reduce our carbon emissions from energy generation by 60% by 2030. And so, for example, funding research into carbon capture and storage is part of our commitment to decarbonizing the economy, as well as driving new jobs in green technologies. So this would be an unprecedented public investment, but as Patrick has laid out, to reach 3%, it needs to be matched by an unprecedented private investment. And how do we enable that? Well, R&D is in some ways its own reward. It's well established that companies that invest in R&D benefit in the long run through higher productivity and growth. And we know, thanks to analysis from Campaign for Science and Engineering, amongst others, that publicly funded R&D creates a strong multiplier effect, crowding in private sector inward investment. So the Campaign for Science and Engineering say that for every £1 spent by the government on R&D, private sector R&D productivity rises by 20% per year in perpetuity. Other multiplier effects used by the government say that every pound, estimate that every pound, of course it depends on the environment, crowds in around 30 pence of private sector investment. So we could expect on that basis that our initial public sector investment would boost investment generally to 2% of GDP. But that's not what our target is. But we believe that government can, set out a series of measures that will deliver on that 3% pledge. And there are a number of ways that we plan to do this. So I'll just go through them now. Now, as Patrick indicated, access to skilled personnel, to skilled people, is sort of one of the number one reasons for companies investing in the UK, but also it's also one of the barriers to businesses expanding R&D programs. So on the one hand, we've said we'll introduce a national education service providing free high quality education from the cradle to the grave, free at the point of consumption, a national health service for the innovation age, and that will also give the opportunity for retraining, because right now, unless you are wealthy past the age of 24, you're unlikely to be able to, you don't get a free education. And unlike the government, we won't impose arbitrary immigration targets, such as the ban on what she calls low-skilled migration, but would hit the science sector, every technician, postdoc, etc., really hard. Instead, we're developing a post-Brexit immigration system based on fairness and economic need. And it was noticeable that in the parliamentary debate on Brexit and science, almost everyone agreed that for innovation, we need to be able to welcome talent in all stages of the sort of scientific development cycle. So technicians as well as top flight scientists. And yet we don't have the plans to do that. Another important factor is transport. Much business R&D happens in collaboration with other businesses and academic institutions, and Labour has pledged to transform our transport network, allowing businesses to take advantage of potential synergies. And one such synergy could be greater collaboration with our health service. I know Matt Hancock talks about how technology can transform and save money in the NHS. We're looking at the possibility of supporting the NHS as a medical innovation hub, to generate real-world evidence for pharmaceutical research and attract investment. Now, on taxation, so our Shadow Treasury team has spent a long time looking at our current tax codes, and looking particularly at simplifying fiscal policy, ensuring in part that it better supports business innovation. And I know my front bench colleagues are well aware of the crucial role R&D tax credits and other schemes, such as SEIS and Entrepreneurs Relief, play for many businesses. It's interesting that the recent IPPR report on economic justice recommended, and I quote, the phasing down and eventual abolition of R&D tax credits, other than for SME firms younger than 7 years, to be replaced with direct funding for innovation. Their basis for that was that had some evidence to suggest that R&D tax credits are not effective. Now, this is not our policy, and it's also not what CTOs and CEOs tell me. But I'm actually disappointed that we haven't seen a comprehensive rebuttal of this recommendation and the evidence for it coming from the sector. Now, I recently visited Oxford Science Park with our Shadow Treasury Minister, Annalise Dodds, to talk just in detail about some of these issues. And I saw, you know, there how these factors, taxation, collaboration, access to skilled labour, have combined to create an environment where business innovation could flourish. But they also said to me that their growth was limited due to poor transport links, how long it took to get from Oxford to Cambridge being just one example, the high price of housing, I know, and both of these, you know, are specific areas that we would, Labour would address. And sort of in terms of, finally, we need to ensure that these benefits are felt by everyone, not just science insiders. We're closely monitoring, I'm sure you are too, the development of the knowledge exchange framework and exploring how, you know, how it could be used to support prosperity in communities across the country. And we're also considering how UKI can best be used to direct research funding to the places that most need it and can most benefit from it. We are the most regionally unequal economy in Europe and second to Mexico when it comes to only Mexico in the OECD. And that is not a recipe for social cohesion or indeed for the best use of talent. So our industrial strategy will also focus on place and devolving the powers locally to address local needs and drive local prosperity. Our National Investment Bank will be made up of a network of regional banks, so investment decisions can be taken locally. I speak of someone who is very familiar with the challenges of getting a banker on a train to Newcastle. But let me tell you, the trains will be better too. And then, you know, we will also be, our industrial strategy is mission-based rather than sector-based, but we recognise the importance of sector, and we'll also be engaging with sectors, setting up sector councils modelled on successful examples such as Automotive Council, but not, unlike the government, it won't be limited to a favoured set of industries. And, for example, we will found a catapult for the retail sector, you know, because to encourage innovation in our largest employment sector. And, I think the points made about businesses accessing these new sources of funding, but also business support, small business support has been almost wiped out over in terms of the capacity of local authorities as well as the Department for Communities to deliver it. And I think universities I know are keen to play a bigger role in supporting knowledge exchange with local businesses, and we can help put in place the local infrastructure to look at that. And particularly, actually, talking about sectors, the creative industries, and again, Patrick referred to this, how are we capturing their sort of research and development? They're a significant part of our economy. They are creativity, for example, the video game sector and AI, there's significant interlap there. How are we capturing that and how are we promoting that? So to conclude, research and development, I believe, as an engineer and as a politician, that research and development should be the engine of progress for our country. Now, to achieve the 3% target, we're setting out a 3% target, and we need to set out the ways in which we'll achieve that. We can increase existing businesses R&D, we can have entirely new R&D intensive businesses, we can attract overseas companies to do R&D here. Our industrial strategy looks, if you like, to do all three of those by supporting our infrastructure, our skills, and our industrial base. It's backed by real investment aligned with a serious approach to Brexit and measures to spread the benefits and sources of science excellent more widely. I think if we get it right, it will be a virtuous circle, and there is no limit to how far we can go, both with investment in science and with our nation's prosperity. Thank you very much.